I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not gonna take this anymore!
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm the dude, so that's what you call me.
Let's go get sushi and not pay.
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
Hoo-ah!
Hey everyone, and welcome to Furious Cinema Podcast. I'm Pete Roberts, and I'm here with my co-host Sebastian Hazelbeck. Hey Seb, how you doing?
Hey Pete, how's it going?
It's going good. So we're back for episode 5, and we chose one of our favorite films, favorite crime film. It's William Friedkin's 1985 film To Live and Die in L.A., which is just, I've been a fan of this since I was like 12 years old. That's when I first saw it, so... I don't know when you first saw it, but
yeah, I must have seen it either on television at some point or when the first DVDs came out. I don't think I saw it earlier than that. Yeah. And to me, it's always been one of those, I want to say, late night movie discoveries during my teenage years, probably.
Right.
And now with the Blu-ray, obviously, there's a whole lot to unpack and rediscover.
Right. But yeah, it's just been one of my favorites, like, because I was a big fan of The French Connection, but I think I saw The French Connection after this, because like I would rent movies back like when I was a little kid, and this was like I just happened to rent it. It was one of those things where I didn't know, this was before I was really, really into film, so I didn't really know who William Friedkin was, or, you know, the history of the anything about the movie. So I just rented it as like an action movie, but then I really loved it, and you know, over the years I've just been a fan of it. So that's where I'm coming from my perspective. But like one of the things about this movie is it's almost like a West Coast version of The French Connection, like a decade later. That's like how I kind of look at it. And, you know, overall, I probably like The French Connection a little bit more, but I love, you know, both of those movies a lot. So I just really think they're great crime films.
Yeah, I didn't even think of that East Coast, West Coast thing. But
yeah, because I mean, there's a lot of similarities there. You have like the two cops.
Yeah.
You one cop is sort of like real hot-headed and kind of like an adrenaline junkie. That's like William Peterson or Gene Hackman's character. Then you have
he's a real hot shot.
Then you have like the sidekick, like his partner, and you have Cloudy, or I think it's Cloudy in French Connection. Then you have Vukovic in To Live and Die in L.A. And there's like a bunch of like little similarities there. And like, of course, like they're both like going after like a big hotshot, you know, criminal, like in Rick Masters in To Live and Die in L.A. And what's his face? The, you know, the French guy in French Connection. I can't remember his name.
Yeah, it's been such a long time since I've seen that one.
Chaunier. I couldn't think of it, but yeah, Chaunier. And so there's like those like little connections. And then of course the two car chases are in both. So there's same type of stuff going on, but different stuff, but you know, it's different, you know, like settings, but it's sort of like the similar like themes going on, you know?
Yeah, and also, like, I was listening to the audio commentary, and one thing that struck me is that he said with this movie, he wanted to go back to how they shot The French Connection, you know, with a small crew. I think they shot outside the union system or something.
But, yeah,
and he liked that kind of minimalistic shooting, just a couple of days, small budget,
yeah.
You know, not a lot of guys standing around doing nothing.
It's sort of like guerrilla filmmaking or something.
Yeah, more like you can more directly translate the energy of the story onto what it is you're actually, you know, producing on the set.
Right.
It doesn't have all that studio baggage, you know. You don't have to carry all that stuff around with you, because it wears you down. It, you know, makes a huge production out of something that doesn't have to be, probably. I figured that was his thinking. I find it funny that there must have been that there was a phase where you didn't know who Friedkin was, because I'm the same way, but I have an excuse. I'm a little younger than you are.
Yeah, you're like 10 years younger than me, so you're like, you know, there's a little bit of a gap there, you know, like you didn't. But it's like I was saying, like when I first saw it, like I didn't know, like, you know, when I was a little kid, I would rent movies and I didn't know about film. I didn't really know about directors or anything like that. I would just rent, like, I'd go up to the shelf and see, like, oh yeah, To Live and Die in LA is a crime film, an action film. I'd just rent it and watch it and that type of stuff. So I didn't know. But then, you know, now I know all about William Friedkin. I know, like, I've seen all his movies now. So, but it's just, but, like, should we explain the setup of the movie? Like, you know, the basic, you know,
Setup of the plot. So basically, for those who are not intimately familiar, this is based on a book by a real life Secret Service agent. So even though, of course, the movie in the end takes a lot of liberties, and I think that it's something like 20% of it is eventually based on the book, but it's about a Secret Service agent who sort of falls out with his outfit, and now he's like working at the Treasury and going after money forgers, and he loses one of his partners to a money forger, criminal mastermind called Masters, played by Willem Dafoe. Mm-hmm. And our protagonist, hotshot cop, played by William Peterson, him and his buddy, they go into investigating the money forgery syndicate or whatever is going down, and the murder of his old partner. And while doing so, they take a bunch of detours. Like, it's immediately clear from the outset that Chance, that's his name, he likes to not play by the rules to get what he wants. And so he plays his CIs and they get closer to Masters. But in the end, where they sort of take the wrong exit, so to speak, and we'll get back to the exit, right. Where they take the wrong exit is that there's a point in the movie where they need a lot of money to do like a deal with Masters about the counterfeit money to bust him. And they can't get that money the legal way. So they do like a deal or something, a diamond fence deal or something that goes wrong. And now they're really in the shit. And
yeah, they're trying to they need money to to give them to buy, gets the counterfeit cash from Masters. So like they kind of kidnap a guy that is supposed to have a whole bunch of money on him. And it turns out this, like, you know, this is part of the movie where it's like, you know, they find out later on that he was like an undercover guy. And like, he ended up getting shot by these other people that were after them.
Yeah. So
it's,
and then they're really,
this whole thing gets but it's like, you know, the whole movie, like, you know, from the very outset, Chance is like, oh, I'm going to do whatever I have to do to get Masters. I don't care if I have to break the law or whatever. You know, he's just doing he's just like basically out for revenge to get this guy. So it's like, you know, for killing his partner. So that's like his whole thing. And he's such like an adrenaline junkie, because like we find out like he loves to do base jumping. He goes up like on bridges and jumps off bridges and stuff, like, you know, for thrills. So it's like, he's that type of guy. So he's like, he's always
beer drinking cowboy boots. Yeah, or whatever. You know, he's sort like a real hothead.
It's interesting because it's not like when it comes to like the setting of the movie, like William Friedkin was trying to do like something more like L.A., like, you know, bright. Like, even if you look at the opening credits, everything's neon, bright orange, you know, like, you know, neon green, neon red, like lots of like bright colors. But Chance himself, he's almost sort of like a, like you're saying, he's not dressed like, you know, Don Johnson in Miami Vice. He's sort of like a old school, like, you know, kind of cowboyish type guy. You know what I mean? Like the way he dresses and stuff, like, you know, leather jacket. And he's not like wearing like, those like white suits or anything like that, like, you know, Don Johnson does. But he's not doing undercover either. But really, well, a little bit he's doing undercover, but getting
it. Yeah. So, there's of course two interesting things here when it comes to the characters. And we talked a little bit about this before we started this conversation, is that when we look back at this movie, which is from the early 80s, the casting of William Peterson as Chance and Willem Dafoe as Masters, now it seems super, super obvious and spot on. But back then, both of them were at the very beginning of their careers. And this movie did something to shape how these two actors would later on be perceived on screen. And now we think back and it's like, yeah, of course. I mean, who else would you cast as Masters other than Willem Dafoe? Well, back then, nobody would have that. Yeah, he was brand new. So that movie did exactly that. It put them on the map, and they were all like from theater, and they did a really excellent job because Friedkin wanted to not cast any big names, which is always a problem if you want to get, you know, studios to back your picture, because the names is what sell the movie.
But then it seems more real when it's not someone you know. Like if you didn't know William Peterson, so it's almost like he's even more of the real guy as opposed to like some big name star like Robert Redford or something. You're just like, oh, it's just Robert Redford playing, you know, himself or something in the movie. But like, you know, but William Peterson had been in Thief. He had a small little part in that. And that was like his first movie, I think. His first, you know, big screen role. It was just a little small. He was playing a little like a bouncer. And if you've seen the movie Thief, he plays a bouncer in the bar. And this was basically his second film. Yeah, this was basically his second film. So, like, you know, he really like came right out of the, you know, out of the Chicago theater, you know, background. So, and then Willem Dafoe had done a few movies. He did like The Loveless, and he did The Streets of Fire, which we talked about on the other podcast. He had been in a few movies, but this was like one of his first big, like, you know, breakout roles. So
it was absolutely awesome. And he's great. I mean, obviously now we know that, but back then, you know, a director would take a risk by hiring these guys.
But I mean, they were all really good. And what was interesting about Willem Dafoe's character is he's the bad guy, but he has like a background. He's like an artist too. So that was sort of different. That's, you don't really see that very often in with like villain roles. He's like, you know, so that's adds another layer to his personality. He's doing like counterfeiting, and that's almost like sort of an art in itself. When you watch the sequence where he's making the money, it's sort of like, that's almost like an offshoot of his art. You know what I mean? Or something like that. It's really interesting. I just thought that was a cool aspect of the character.
Yeah, he's even, like a painter. Even further, I mean, he looks at what he's doing as a kind of art, and maybe even, you know, maybe even he even looks at his like real art as maybe he looks at himself as kind of a failed artist.
You know what?
Maybe you know something what? That bugs him and drives him to, you know, into that kind of, or whatever.
I never really even thought about that till right now, but it kind of connects to the movie, how he is in the movie, because since he kind of like isn't where he wants to be as an actual artist, he's very, very obsessive about his paper, was what he calls it, the counterfeit money. So like whenever something goes wrong, he's really like, you know, he doesn't want his paper being used by anybody unless he gets like, you know, money for it, actual money for it. You know, he's selling his like fake counterfeit money for money, real money. But it's like he has this thing about that throughout the movie. And it's almost like maybe like psychologically, he's like very like obsessed about that because he's not like an actual artist. So it's like, I don't know if that's the case, but it's interesting to think about.
Yeah, and it's also not that he's like a huge crime kingpin in this movie. Because he's, you know, there's a moment where they all go to like the sauna and whatever. And there's like a certain degree of honor or whatever left in what he's doing, and he might be ruthless, but he's not like a huge mafia crime boss or anything. He's more like
has a code. Like a literal, I think he has a
psycho
code.
There's like something psycho about him, and you know, forging money is, that might have been something that he came into by accident or so. We never know.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but I think he does have like his own code, like the way he does business and stuff. But he's like, you know, he's wicked, like ruthless too. At the same time, like when you see like the very beginning, like when Chance's partner finds the place where the counterfeit money's been being like made, and Willem Dafoe is there. You know, Rick Masters is there. Like, just, you don't think he's going to be there, but he is there. Like, he's hiding out in like a little, I don't know what it is, like a horse trailer or something like that on the side of the place. Mm-hmm. But he like, you know, then he just catches the guy and he like just blows his head off with a shotgun. So it's like he's very ruthless in this movie. Like, he's just, he's pretty like fearless in this film. It's like a really awesome character.
But he's and even badass. More so, I mean, obviously for the 80s that became kind of fashionable, but also Friedkin paints Masters as someone who's who's got a lot of different sides to him. So
That's what I like about the character.
There's a lot of eroticism in the movie, and he seems to be, I don't know if it's even, you know, bisexual maybe or something. He likes to watch, so he's got like a voyeuristic thing going, and there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of physicality in the movie in a lot of ways. You know, for Chance, it's all about, you know, masculinity and jumping off of bridges and running after guys. But for Masters,
he's more like an artist. I mean, Masters is more of like an artist. So it's like all like the places he go, he's very like all the people he knows and like hangs around with there. So, well, one guy isn't, but he's coming from like the artist side of like L.A. And then, you know, William Peterson is coming more from like, you know, the old school, like, you know, tough guy like side of things. But another thing I wanted to mention was the difference between like the French Connection. Another difference between the French Connection and this movie is the fact that these guys are Secret Service agents. And what I didn't know was that the Secret Service, they have like two main things that they do. They protect the president and they go after counterfeiters. I just thought that was an interesting thing, as opposed to just being like an LA beat cop or something. You know what I mean? Like, that's just an interesting angle to come from. You know what I mean? Cause I didn't even know that. I didn't know that about the Secret Service. I never knew those were like the two main things that they do, that they take care of.
Okay, is that because formerly they're part of the Treasury Department?
Yeah, it's because they're part of the Treasury, but like when you think of the Secret Service, you always think of them just protecting the president. Yeah. I never knew about the counterfeit money like aspect of it. So I just thought that was an interesting, you know, an interesting story to tell, as opposed to just doing like, you know, having Chance be just like an LA cop, like vice cop or something. I just thought that was a cool thing, like aspect of the story.
And also setting that in a place that you wouldn't associate with that kind of story. So if it was a story about, you know, Secret Service agents protecting the president, it would probably take place in DC or something, or on a plane. Yeah. Or
then like we have to talk about the chase scene in the movie. Like that's like one of the main, like, you know, the main highlights of the film is that chase. And that's like, that happens after they try to get the money from that guy that they kidnap, you know, whatever he is. He's like, they don't know he's an undercover cop, but they go like, they get him from a train station and then they're like being chased by these guys. But you know what? I didn't exactly pick up who those guys were that were chasing them. I didn't know if they were,
and I don't think they weren't Masters either.
I mean,
Chance and his partner, they didn't know either. Cause I think that's the moment where they realized they were completely out of their depth.
Right. They were. It's like, I didn't know who those guys that were chasing them were, because it was just like, oh yeah, who are these guys? And they're saying that as they're driving, you know, as these people are chasing them, and they're like, what the hell is going on? And that chase scene is like one of the best things ever.
Yeah.
And it's so awesome.
Yeah. And there's a thing in the audio commentary where Friedkin says he wanted that whole sequence to be Kafka-esque you know, with Kafka-esque stories is all about somebody who's being paranoid, but there's always a truth to it. So he wanted them to feel like they were being chased from everywhere, and they were.
Yeah, it was very, and I have a passage from his book that I wanted to like just read, like, you know, a little bit of from his like point of view, like on doing a chase scene. And he says, the chase is the purest form of cinema, something that can't be done in any other medium, not literature, not on stage, nor on a painter's canvas. A chase must appear spontaneous and out of control, but it must be meticulously choreographed, if only for safety considerations. The audience should not be able to foresee the outcome. It helps to have innocent bystanders who would be hurt or killed.
Didn't they film it by the other cars going the other way?
Yeah, they filmed, but there's a part where they're like the William Peterson's car is driving, and but what they did was they just have cars parked like, you know, it still like, you know, parked standing still on the side of the road, so look, you wouldn't know like they weren't moving type thing, because the other car was moving. It's kind of hard to explain. Like he says, actual high-speed chases take place in big city traffic or on crowded freeways. Pace doesn't imply speed. Sometimes the action should slow to a crawl or even a dead stop, build and stop, leading to an explosive climax. It also helps to keep a left to right, right to left continuum, so the audience understands the geography. I'm not concerned about this when shooting dialogue or other scenes, but with a chase, it must be clear where person A is in relation to person B. If A goes left or right, B should follow the same route. So he gives like a whole thing about like, you know, what what his theory on those. And then he like kind of compares this one to like, you know, Bullet and, you know, Ronin, like, you know, those other really good chase scenes. And I mean, to me, like, I think, you know, I think I like this one more than the one in French Connection. I mean, it's, but the French Connection one is so like iconic now, but I mean, this one is like so raw and like just crazy and all over the place type thing. It's more of like, it would really be if like they really did something like this, that type of thing.
Yeah.
Seems very genuine, like a really authentic type, like, you know, chase scene, because they're going.
Yeah, it feels super rough and raw and right. and interestingly, it feels super fast. But even though they shot it completely differently, they, you know, they didn't have any CGI or whatever. So that's kind of a huge effort
that they were able to do that. But then, like, you watch the one in Ronin, that's a pretty awesome chase scene too, because, like, you know, they're in Europe going through the tunnels and stuff backwards. I think most of it is backwards, but going backward, you know. The opposite
way. But it's also more than 20 years later with a lot different capabilities.
Right, that's true too. But
which was not filmed by Bobby Mueller, but
what's his name? I forgot the guy's name.
So the stunt guy is Buddy Joe Hooker, of course, and the
I remember the guy who took over instead of Robbie Mueller, the
camera guy, Yeoman,
Robert Yeoman, second unit. Mm-hmm. The second unit cameraman, so he shot that because Robin Mueller wasn't sure he could do it or something, so that's how they did that. But
and of course it's not the only chase sequence in the movie, but it's the only real car chase. There's a bunch of other chases in there which I also liked. I find that part of Chance's character is that not only is he, you know, psychologically like a driven person or someone who's like restless, but like he likes the physicality. He likes to run after guys, jump fences, stuff like that, and all what the I while always, wearing cowboy funny, boots and stuff. Yeah.
But what I found funny about the character of Chance is like a couple of times in the movie, he has his ass kicked by other, like the criminals. Like he'll be like that coat, like John Turturro's Cody. Like he'll be like, you know, he's kind of like falls for one of his like tricks, like, and then in John Turturro like just like beats the crap out of him, like knocks him out cold. And then like there's another part where, like, you know, that's the part where you know they kidnap that guy that they think is like a, you know, whatever he is, like, you know, he has a bunch of money that they want to use to pay off Masters mm-hmm. with, and like that guy end up like kicks him right in the shin or something, and he falls down, so he gets like kind of like his ass kicked a couple of times. I thought that was kind of funny the way they did that. Usually they never have like the, you know, the hero getting like beat up by the like these like, you know, scumbag criminal guys. I just thought that was funny.
Yeah, in a way, I mean, I don't want to overinterpret it, but he's not the greatest cop.
Yeah, he's sort of like, you know, he's sort of like he's very reckless, of course.
He's reckless, yeah. That's part of
his, you know, his nature, but that's what makes it interesting, though. He's sort of flawed, and he thinks like, you know, he thinks he's the biggest badass ever. It's just like that type of character. Those types of like, you know. Like, you know, the whole thing, like when, you know, they're trying to, he's just breaking every rule he can break to get Masters, basically. And, you know, he's just doing whatever he has to do. So that's what makes it really fun to watch. It makes it more interesting.
Yeah. And also the kind of relationship, I mean, first of all, to his partner, who's the one who likes to do more by the book. And,
right,
and
right,
there's,
right,
there's
right.
a point where they kind of fall out over his, over Chance's practices, but also the relationships that he has to his CIs, where one of them is a CI / girlfriend, something, but he clearly uses her and pays her.
Yeah, he does. I think she was like, she was some like hooker or something, that like our drug related like person that like she was in jail, and I guess he helped her get out of jail, and she's like an informant for him now. So it's like, but then they're having like, you know, like sex and stuff at the same time. So it's like, he's kind of like using her, and, you know, it's like, he doesn't like give a shit about, like, I don't think he gives a shit about her, but it's like that type of thing.
And I mean, in the end, it becomes clear that he had feelings. And but the, what I was going to say is that there's a few other relationships that are interesting. And one of them is, of course, the one between him and Masters, because in a way, the two guys who are flawed in their really own ways and are kind of, you know, fucked up in their own ways.
Right.
They met kind of their match, and there's a few moments in the movie where you think, you know, they get along really well.
Yeah, they're like,
and,
you know,
it's... And Friedkin says that, and he's, I found it puzzling, and he doesn't really go too much into it, but a number of times in the audio commentary, he says, the movie is not just about counterfeit money. It's about counterfeit relationships. So these relationships are always kind of skewed or not what they're supposed to be and stuff like that.
Everybody's kind of half scamming everybody, like, you know, whether it's Chance and his partner or, you know, him and the girl or, you know, Defoe, you know, like they're all kind of like scamming each other, like with what they're doing. But, you know, one thing I noticed, one character actor I noticed in this, that I don't know if you've seen the movie Touch of Evil.
Yeah.
That one, the film noir, the Orson Welles movie. Remember
he's the DA or something.
Yeah, punk kid that was in that movie. He plays as like a DA in this, which was really weird to see him after all those years. Like, I don't think I've seen him in anything else, but I just thought that was cool to like see that guy like after all those years.
Yeah,
sort of like a nice little noir connection there, like a neo noir to film noir connection. I don't know his name though. I forgot his name. It's he's a Mexican actor, I think. I can't remember.
Yeah, or at least the name is yeah. And that's a great scene too. Like you could see Chance.
Yeah, that's one of those
going in being the hot shot, and then
that's one of those like, you know, that's
going up against kind of the system that he's supposed to be classic, a part of.
It's the classic scene where, you know, the cop goes in to see like, you know, the higher up guy, and like he's like pissed off because he's not helping him and stuff, and like they have like a, you know, like a little confrontation and stuff. That it's like that type of scene, but then, you know, he ends up helping him, I think so.
And then of course, one thing that we haven't really touched upon so much is I mean, you mentioned it a little bit, but with the orange and I think the gloomy look of the LA that he captures is kind of part of this how the characters are shady and everything.
Yeah.
He paints the entire city like that. It's about the lines are blurred. There's no black and white. You know, everyone's kind of hustling. You got to show some grit, you know. This is all part of this little gritty version of Los Angeles.
And he did that on purpose. Like instead of like picking out like the most popular places in Los Angeles, he kind of found a whole bunch of places like on the fringes of Los Angeles. So it has like that.
Yeah, it's almost unrecognizable to someone who's never been there. Yeah.
It just has that. That's what makes it more like authentic when you're watching it. You're not like, you know, going to the main, like, you know, attractions in Los Angeles. It's all these like kind of like grungy places, like strip clubs and like little like seedy bars, like out on who knows where on the edge of the town and stuff. Like that's what made it like really cool.
And it's almost like the canals are the most recognizable places that they found.
And they shot a lot of it in gang territory, like, you know, Watts and South Central and East Los Angeles, those types of places. So
yeah, I like that movie Colors.
Yeah, Colors, right. That's like
Colors.
Yeah, that's a good little movie too. That was like a little loss, you know.
Yeah, I love that too. Yeah, that's a great movie.
Yep, very cool. And let's see. The car chase sequence took 6 weeks to shoot. That was the last thing they shot. So that's pretty crazy. That's a long time. 6 weeks. Wow. That's amazing.
But he also mentions that there's one thing that they went back and reshot because he forgot that the movie needed that. And I think that was the opening part of, you know, where he's the secret agent and with that card game going on and whatever. Yeah. At least in the audio commentary, he says they actually did that in the end and reshot it because it was in the book and he thought it was obvious to him, but then, you know, watching his rough cut, it dawned on him that, you know, they didn't shoot any of it.
Yeah,
and the audience obviously doesn't know any of it.
Yeah. And also, I guess like he didn't even want like the main theme of the song that starts the movie. He didn't even want that when he originally was going to hire Wang Chung. He just wanted them to do like, you know, instrumental music, an instrument. But then they created that song and then he just loved it so much. He put it in the very beginning of the movie. So that was pretty cool. Did you say you're not a fan of the movie, the music in the movie, or
not at all? I mean, some parts of the instrument, some of the instrumental stuff is okay, but I don't. Yeah. I'm not. You know, this whole instrumental.
You're not into
German
80s,
club
not into
80s in the stuff. 80s. Synth,
yeah, you don't like. You don't like 80s music or something or 80s
no,
stuff.
No, not really. I mean, depends. I mean, there's of course different, but this is a little bit too synthy, whatever for me.
synth pop stuff for. But I like. I've always liked it. I always liked Wang Chung's music. I thought it was pretty cool, but
it's an interesting choice that kind of it matches the kind of neon.
That's what that's what it is. The movie. It's like if you watch like the French Connection, that's like a totally different type of score. It's like there's no like, you know, it's not, of course, it's not like synth pop music. It's like this weird, like it's a lot of like brass horns and like it's just very like
more jazzy,
blaring like. It's yeah, it's sort of like different. It's this is more like coming from like the 80s, like new wave, like you know modern neon, you know that bright warm. It's bright and warm as opposed to cold and dark, like, you know, French Connection was. So it's like it has like those two things from different opposite sides.
And we all know who would have done the music if Walter Hill had made this one.
Oh yeah, it would be I don't know if Ry Cooder's music would have been good in it. I mean, you know, it would have been good, but it would have been different. It would have been like a lot of
he's a chameleon, he can do anything.
It'd be like a lot of like slide guitar music or something. Ry Cooder. I don't know what it would be, but I love that's another thing I love in this movie is like that the beat of like, you know, the score. I love like, you know, when he's like it, that's really what drive that sound drives like the movie, like the action sequences and stuff, all the when it like, you know, when it's when he's making the money, like, you know, it just really like pumps up the scenes a lot. That's why I love it. It's that's, you know, that synth with drumming and stuff, it's just really cool.
You mentioned the French Connection a lot, and I was going to ask you. I mean, I'm not the biggest Friedkin buff, so I've seen a number of his films. I mean, but
yeah, you've seen.
Where would you place this one? I mean, obviously, it's more towards his earlier work rather than his later work. But
it's interesting to hear from you how you my top five. If I had my top five, like I'd have like The Exorcist, I'd have French Connection, I'd have. Sorcerer, I'd have this movie, and then like Cruising, I think would probably be my, is that five or four? But like, you know, it would be in my top list of his, my favorite movies from him. The ones he did after, I actually didn't see a lot of the ones, like I didn't see the one he did before this was, which was Deal of the Century. I didn't see that one. And I didn't see like several of the other ones he did after this. Like I don't think I saw Rampage or like some of these other ones. They were just like movies that were like, I don't know. They fell through the cracks, or I just didn't see them, or, you know, I just don't know. I didn't see them on like the shelf or what.
But. Did you like any of the ones that he did in the later years? Like, for example, The Hunted with the.
I saw that one. I did like that. But
yeah, it's pretty good.
But like, I'm it's just one of those things where you're always comparing it to like the older work. Like I liked it. I thought it was a solid film. But like, do I like it more than this one or, you know, French Connection? No, it's not on. I don't think it was on that level. It was good though for a newer movie. It's like, you know, it's just the way I see the way I like rate things in that way, you know.
It definitely took me a long time until I saw Sorcerer, and I liked it, but I don't like it as much as the original that it's based on. But it's a pretty amazing movie.
The original is the Wages of Fear, is it?
Yeah.
Like I think I've seen both of those like once, and I think, you know, so I don't know, I can't really say which one I like more, which, because I just haven't seen them enough like to like really like go back and forth to like compare them. But I did like Sorcerer a lot. I thought that was really like a good film, but.
You know, also, I mean, another thing that, you know, this is a little bit off, a bit of a detour now, but The Exorcist, I thought it was one of the lamest movies I've ever seen, but I saw it like only maybe a couple of years ago, and that was the first time I saw it, and I just laughed my ass off, and I thought it was just...
Maybe it's because you're older or something, maybe, but I mean, I find
it... The effects don't work anymore, and it's not scary.
It's weird how, like, your point of view, like you thought it wasn't like very good, but I find it like to be the most like terrifying movie I've ever seen, like compared to like everything. Like, I don't know. Like, is there any movie that scares you more than The Exorcist? What would it be?
Yeah, all of them.
But I mean, it's like
any horror movie,
but it's like, I don't get scared by horror movies, but this one, The Exorcist was so real. Like it seemed so real. That's what it was. It wasn't that like, it was just the authentic feeling of it, of, you know, being like in that, and like feeling it, the evil, like take over this person. And like, just the way it's shot and like the whole atmosphere is what, it's just creepy as hell. It's just so like disturbing.
Yeah. But if I contrast it to something from that era, like Rosemary's Baby, I think Rosemary's Baby is way scarier.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's scary, but it's in a different way though. It's like The Exorcist is very visceral and it's disturbing, like terror. It's just so like, you know, with all the puking and all like that, her head spinning around and like all the crazy voices, like by Mercedes McCambridge, I think, did the voice of Regan when she was like, you know, and she, it was just like disturbing. It was everything, like, and it was all the stuff together. It was what made it disturbing all the way. Mm-hmm. I think it's a masterpiece of like, you know, that type of cinema, but I guess, you know, everybody has their own views of what's, but Rosemary's Baby is another one. That's a great one too.
Yeah. That, and actually, cause you know, I went through his filmography and I thought, oh, which movies of him have I seen? I actually liked some of his later stuff. Obviously The Hunted, cause I like this kind of survival, you know, it's also, yeah, The Hunted, I think. And then also he did one that was kind of on the creepy spectrum, was called Bug or The Bug.
I saw that. That was a good one. That was like a real paranoia filled type movie. Like,
exactly. It was a paranoia, and you never knew what it was real or not. And there's like another one called The Guardian or Guardian.
Yeah, The Guardian. That's okay. The one he did after To Live and Die in LA, I think. I think he did that right after this. Or no, he did it after Rampage. So it was a few years after that, but I never saw that.
Yeah, that's from 91. It's also pretty cool, I think.
Yeah, I never saw that. I never saw like some of those, but. And I don't think I've even seen Killer Joe yet. That's one of his more recent ones. I never saw that with Matthew McConaughey. I just never watched it. It's like a few years ago. And
I'm not sure. Yeah, I don't think I've seen it.
I have my favorite of his, and like this would be like this film is in the top five. So, but yeah, I'm trying to
think. Yeah, I gotta rewatch The French Connection and both of them because it's been such a long time for me.
Yeah, that's The French Connection. I've watched so many times. Like I'll rewatch it like four or five times a year. Just that's how much I like it. It's one of my most favorite films. So I just and he won an Academy Award for that one. I think just one. I think, I'm not sure. Or yeah, one best director or best film. I can't remember. But
I mean, obviously, To Live and Die in LA, one of the reasons it has a special place in my heart, and I'm probably part of that audience that, you know, discovered it late and probably rediscovered it recently or something with the Blu-ray or whatever, because sometimes it takes a certain trigger for someone to rediscover a certain movie. And for me, it's often the case when movies get, you know, restored or get a proper release on home video that they really deserve, and this is probably one of them. But I'm a huge fan of this kind of gloomy, gritty urban drama. That's also why I love Michael Mann, for example.
That's why you love The French Connection. If you haven't, have you seen it at all, or did you?
No, I've seen it. I've seen it many years ago.
That one is
like
really awesome. I mean, that's just so like, it's almost like a semi-documentary type film of like, you know, of that story. So it's just very gritty and very like, you know.
And I think the most interesting Michael Mann connection is Manhunter, because of the setting and the main star is the same. I thought it was. When I watched Live and Let Die in LA this week for this podcast, Manhunter came to mind as something. Oh my God, I need to rewatch that because
it's an awesome film.
It's like a good double feature.
Yeah, it is definitely. And they both have that sort of like neat, like kind of bright neonish, like, you know, like that type of like atmosphere to them. Like they're kind of like new wave cinema, you know, 80s new wave cinema to them, that, you know, with the music and the characters are sort of like, you know, it's just a different, but they also have like the dark grittiness to them at the same time, like you were saying. It's like they have like that weird, like, you know, combination of bright and dark, and, you know, it's just awesome cinema.
Yeah, and it's you know, Of course, I'm as much a fan of a good like police procedural as the next guy, but I like that in a movie like this, the whole police procedural stuff takes a backseat to great characters battling it out in front of like the urban epic jungle. It's almost like it's a jungle out there because there's, you know, the as you said, where they filmed it and whatever, it's it's not the most obvious spots. Nothing is clean. It's almost a bit anarchic. It's not like this isn't Blues Brothers. There isn't like a million police cars because you know, in the end, it's just two guys out by themselves and you know, left to their own wits.
Kind of like outlaws or something in a way. Like, you know what I mean? Chance and Masters are sort of outlaws in their own way. They're both you know, one's coming from the, you know, the quote unquote good side. The other guy is like just trying to, you know, make his money by doing counterfeiting. And it's like, but it's just, I don't know. I thought both actors were just incredible in those roles. They were just, they really knocked it out of the park, I thought.
And what I found really like really nice of Friedkin is that he could have gone down an even darker road with this movie towards the end, but I think it ends with a, I don't want to call it an optimistic note, but it ends with a slight, you know.
We didn't get into like the actual like since we're just doing spoilers in these podcasts, we should just say the whole movie. But the you know, it actually what he did at the end was very, very much like against like the way Hollywood movies usually end, because in this film the main character gets his head blown off and he dies. But you know, in the, you know, they do the you know, the money switch, or, you know, the money.
Yeah, but the girl gets the money.
And the, you know, there's the whole thing just goes totally wrong. Masters like sidekick ends up just shooting William Peterson, like, you know, just blowing him away. And it just like, you're like, what the hell? Because back then, don't forget, like when you're watching this movie back in like 1985, they didn't do that back then. They didn't have like the, you know, it'd be like having Rambo get killed, like at the end of the movie. They didn't do like those types of things. Or like, you know, John McClane and Die Hard, like having him get killed. That was like a total, like, you know, what the hell type like ending. So, I mean, that was really like out of the blue. But now I also thought it was interesting, like how his partner like kind of like ends up taking on his personality and stuff. I thought, I didn't quite get that, but it was a really interesting way to do it, the way to do the ending. I just didn't. But it's just weird, like one of those kind of like leaves you scratching your heads, like you don't know.
Well, yeah, because there is a certain bond, even though they're both, you know, they're both different in as far as they want to cross the line.
Right.
But in the end, you know, they're partners.
So it's like he kind of
feel
like
a responsibility for each other.
Yeah. So he kind of like ended up being like, you know, kind of like turning into like Chance, which was weird. And then he goes to see his girlfriend at the very end. So it's like he's like taking on his like life or something, taking on his like personality or something. So I thought it was cool. It was just an interesting, strange way to end the film. And you know, that along
I liked it. I think it has at least a certain positive note to it in a way. I mean, obviously, you know, and
like, who knows?
We learn a lot about the one female character who, you know, who schemed a little bit against Masters in a way, but then also the other, you know, the girl gets the money or something.
Right.
And so even though Chance is dead, it's like,
I mean, it's like, you know, that was,
we're not crying at the end.
No, you're not crying, but you're just like, you know, what the hell, but,
Definitely. I didn't look up about the international availability of the Blu-ray, but I do want to for whoever is a fan, do get the kind of Blu-ray that has the audio commentary and maybe some of the interviews. Mine has a bunch of interviews also. That's the German one. I think it must be the same as the Twilight or something.
Right.
Disc, and it has a bunch of interviews on it also, and I think that's really worth it because you can, you know, rewatch the movie and get into Friedkin's head like you did with, you know, reading his book.
Yeah, that was that was a really great book. If you're a fan of William Friedkin, it's called The Friedkin Connection. So it goes through his whole career, like, you know, from like when he first started, like he started like in documentaries, like way back, like in the '60s, and like then he did a few little movies. Like before the French, and then of course he did the French Connection. That was like sort of his big breakout hit, and he won an Oscar for that. And then that would kind of set him on his path to like doing all those other great movies. And, you know, after that, so definitely an awesome read. I loved it. One of my favorite film books. So
I think he also did, I'm not sure if he did an audio commentary or just a bigger interview, but on the disc of Sorcerer,
yep.
There's also a lot of Friedkin on it. So
Yeah. I haven't seen the one with the audio commentary, but.
And isn't I think the French Connection is also like a two disc something special collection or something.
Yep.
So that's
pretty cool. I was rewatching To Live and Die in LA last night, and I thought it was sort of funny. Like they at one point they come back to the station and they walk through the office. I think they're like bringing like some weapons back or something like that into like the weapons room, and they walk by and there's a black and white cardboard cutout of I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Electric Glide in Blue, but it's like a, mm-hmm. a Robert Blake movie. There's like a little like cardboard cutout of him like in one of the offices. I thought that was kind of funny, a cool little, like, you'd have to like really look close to find that, but that was really cool little like little little trivia fun fact there. That was pretty
neat. And Robert Downey Sr. is also, he's like their supervisor or something, right?
Yeah. And I was saying how I'm a big fan of the movie Putney Swope. So like, you know, like I saw him show up in this and it was just funny. Like it's almost like you can hear his, cause he does the voice of Putney Swope in the movie. Mm-hmm. So it's like, when you hear his voice, it's like, you're listening to like Putney Swope talking. I thought that was kind of funny. It was pretty cool. But yeah, that was a cool little role. And he's sort of like, you know, the standard, like, you know, guy like in charge, like, you know, telling him like, you know, that you're doing everything wrong and you're screwing up and, you know, that type of stuff. The angry, you know, boss of the guys. And Dean Stockwell plays Rick Masters' attorney, I think is what he's doing, I think.
Yeah, he's also a seedy, yeah. Seedy character.
Yeah, he's sort of like a seedy character, but then like he ends up like kind of like talking to Vukovic like about like, you know, what's going on and stuff. And he sort of doesn't like, he doesn't have any like real you know, he doesn't have any like he's just not like dedicated to Rick Masters at all. He's just like kind of like out to like make money. Just, so he doesn't care like what he does.
Yeah,
yeah, right.
So yeah, it's definitely, I would say it definitely ranks among the great crime films that we both like and love. And yep. It's a really, you know, as you said, it's up there with Friedkin's best work. And
right.
It's ripe for a rediscovery for those listening who haven't seen it in a while. You know, go back, get the Blu-ray, rediscover it. It's definitely worth it, I would say. Yeah.
Was there any Blu-rays you wanted to like bring up, like that are coming out that you wanted to like recommend? Or
there's a few. Obviously, the usual suspects are what we put on the GCDB calendar, right. and the Spaghetti Western Database calendar. There's a bunch of interesting, like, more exploitation-y stuff coming out. I think there's some interesting crime flicks coming out, like
I want to see Grand Slam.
I was just gonna say, yeah, okay. Grand Slam. Yeah,
that's one I wanted to see.
That's coming out this year, and then Thriller Cruel Picture is coming out. I think next month.
And that Rogue Cops and Racketeers box, we've kind of mentioned them on both the podcasts, like, you know, the 42nd Street Forever and this one. So those are like,
yeah, and there's another one that should be interesting for Charlie Brunson fans. That also, so Grand Slam comes out in April. I think Breakout is also a pretty neat little Brunson movie that often goes overlooked. Also comes out in April.
Mm-hmm.
And Violent City in May, finally. Oh, yeah. So the UK announcement is already out. The US announcement should follow shortly.
Yeah, and I just noticed Heavy Metal is coming out on 4K Blu-ray, that classic.
Yeah, you know, I watched that not too long ago. I was blown away by it. It's almost like, you know, a trip. Yeah. Such a trip.
Yeah, it's a crazy movie. It's like an animated film. And that'll be a good one for like cult film fans. They'll like want to get that one. There's a great soundtrack on there. You know, Black Sabbath, Blue Oyster Cult, Cheap Trick, Devo, like all these different groups.
Yeah, really, and for the 4K crowd, the Sergio Leone's $2 movies are going to come out in 4K Ultra HD.
Oh, really?
May
I didn't know that. Is that what country is that in, United States or?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, really?
From Kino Lorber.
Cool. That's awesome. Just wondering, have you seen any recent movies that you really like that you're like could bring up at all or anything?
Yeah, so I watched a lot of crap recently.
Yeah, a lot of like that Netflix crap.
For some reason, like I have the Letterboxd stats, and Scott Eastwood is already topping the list of most watched. Nobody needs Scotty Eastwood, really. One thing that that's recent and I liked and would recommend is the Django and Django documentary that's on Netflix now. It's about, you know, documentary about Sergio Corbucci. That should definitely be up on anyone's list for those who are film buffs. And I've recently seen Benedetta, finally, the Paul Verhoeven movie, and that's of course very Verhoeven, but also worth it.
Benedetta was I just watched Juice, which is a movie like that I was a big fan of when I was a teenager, and that was from 1992. Ernest Dickerson, and that was like, you know, another crime movie that was really good.
And I've been trying to you know fill a few gaps in my list of Japanese movies to watch and some Hong Kong movies and a few things I already published on FuriousCinema.com, but I plan reviewing a few more. I got Full Alert here, and maybe I'm gonna do a little Sonny Chiba Street Fighter night, and maybe I'll write up something about that. And as you know, I sometimes go out and it's almost like a chore. I want to fill a few gaps, and some of the gaps I have are obviously, you know, I don't even want to talk about them because I'm ashamed. But otherwise, you know, just, you know,
like it's like classic movies that you haven't seen or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes, you know, it might be a movie where there's no real reason that I haven't seen them. It's just they haven't, you know, the movie and me.
You haven't seen Forrest Gump.
Kind of like that. No, not like that. But for example, I've never seen The Rear Window.
For some
reason. But then recently I watched the Toolbox Murders, and I'm gonna write for the GCDB.
You didn't love Toolbox Murders, I guess. It was just sort of
It's not the greatest movie. Yeah. It's notorious and it's interesting, but it's not the greatest movie.
Right. No. Yeah, I mean. I rewatched The Mechanic. What I find happens is like every year, with the start of the new year, I'll like start out like just rewatching all my favorite films. Then as the year goes on, I'll kind of like find new ones and find like stuff I haven't seen. Mm-hmm. It's like almost like I'm like refreshing myself like on like movies by just like rewatching stuff I already have seen and that I love. So I watched like The Mechanic with Charles Bronson and Jan Michael Vincent. Then I watched Falling Down. I watched Falling Down like, you know, a lot during. I don't know. It's one of my favorite films.
I love it too.
Awesome. I just love that movie. That's another one of those movies like you'll just revisit a lot. I just really like it. And then, you know, I watch like all types of stuff. Like all, you know, I'll watch exploitation films. I'll watch like, you know, a documentary. I'll watch just everything. And, you know, so like I rewatched Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors, and I hadn't seen that in like a long time, like probably 20 years. So that's
I just watched Texas Chainsaw 3D the other day, which is I thought it wasn't so bad.
Yeah, I mean they're not bad, but it's just like I'm kind of like lost on like how many sequels and prequels there are now for Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I don't even know like it's like every other year another Leatherface movie comes out. It's
and now there's a Netflix series that's coming out.
You know? The Revenge. You know, it's like I don't even know what the hell is going on with the Texas Chainsaw. And then there's going to be another one now, right? With I don't know who's doing the newest one, but some.
A Netflix show or something.
Yeah, I don't know it's going to be a show on Netflix.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, I didn't even know that. But I mean, I've watched like so much stuff, and you know.
I mean, you got to hand it to the guy; he's hard to kill.
Yeah, I guess so. But I mean, it's like I don't know. Now it's like, I guess the latest one is he's going to be like, it's going to be like taking place now. So he's like, how old would Leatherface be now? Like 85 years old? I don't know. Like how old he's 70 years old? I have no idea.
Yeah, it's weird.
If he was 30 back in 1973, then he'd be whatever it would be. I don't know what. But another documentary I really liked was Django and Django, Sergio.
Yeah, I mentioned that just now. Yeah.
That's really good. That was really good. And it was just like listening to like, you know, all this stuff about his, I'm a big fan of like all those movies. I was just thinking to myself, like, I like almost all the ones I've seen by him, but I didn't really like I think I saw the Specialists. Is that what it's called? The Specialists.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that once, but I didn't see, like, I've seen the other ones more than once, but
I'm not the biggest fan of it, but maybe I need to rewatch it.
I didn't like it as much as his other ones, but I love, like, you know, Navajo Joe and Minnesota Clay and all those ones. I
recently actually rewatched Minnesota Clay on the Blu-ray that came out, and it's actually, I think it was pretty good.
Yeah, and you know what one I really like that I've watched a couple times now, that's sort of like going up the list, like, is The Hellbenders. I thought that was an awesome film. Mm-hmm. I just love that story.
Joe Cotton.
Yeah, Joe is, like, you know, they're bringing, like, the money back in the you know, the coffin, or, you know, mm-hmm. across the, in, like, you know, they're just trying to get through, like, all the different, you know, obstacles. And so I just love that story. It was really good the way they did it.
Also, to make a connection to one of the previous episode that we did, I actually finally watched Brewster's Millions.
Oh yeah, Brewster's Millions. I haven't seen that in a while, but it was pretty good, right? It wasn't too bad, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's out of his usual, you know, profile of movies that he does. Yeah,
but, Walter Hill, right? Walter Hill.
Yeah, Walter Hill. Interesting.
And what was the premise? Like, he had to do something.
He would get like $5 million if he would he would get like $50 million or $300 million if he managed first to spend $5 million or so.
Oh yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
He can't spend it on assets. He just has to like waste it, and he can't just give it away either.
That was sort of a fun film. Like, yeah. I watched another movie that's sort of like in that same type of vein, which was called Easy Money, and it's Rodney Dangerfield, and it's sort of like a thing like where he has to like lose a certain amount of weight. I can't remember exactly what he has to do, but like, you know, he has to do it by a certain time, and like, then he'll get like, you know, the money, like, you know, the money from his mother-in-law. It was really a mm-hmm. funny movie. I love that. And Joe Pesci is in it. And like, you know, all these funny characters. It's one of my favorite little comedies from the 80s.
I watched another movie that was one of your favorites of last year. It's Pig.
Oh yeah. Pig. Did you like that one? Yeah, I really liked that one. Oh yeah, another movie I wanted to mention that I really love, that's a newer one, is Boiling Point, that new movie with Stephen Graham. That was awesome. It was like it's all done in one take, like one shot. So okay. It's like, it was just I love that. I mean, it's like, you know, like 1917, like how they did the whole thing. Like, well, you know, they did some tricks, like, so it wasn't just one shot. They did some cameras, like, you know, effect stuff. But it's like that same type of thing, like where you're just following people like through the whole movie and then one shot. So they're like going mm-hmm. walk, but it takes place in like a restaurant, and he's like a chef, and he has like all these like personal problems, and he's trying to like deal with all the idiot, like, you know, chefs and stuff that he has to deal with. It's really good. I thought it was excellent. Really good film. Really like.
I like the Letterboxd reviews. There's one that just says "fuck Table 7."
Yeah, and then it's like, I'm reading one right now. Fucking brilliant. That's the review. Fucking brilliant.
Okay, put it on my list.
Yeah, I mean, it was good. And the top one says the acting was so real, you felt like you were in the kitchen with these people. Yeah, that's I agree. Wow. another fun one. Compliments to the chef. That's a good one. So I mean, yeah,
So one of the things I really need to do the next couple of days is finally watch Nightmare Alley.
And, oh yeah, yeah, the newest one. Yeah, I haven't seen that yet.
If I get a chance, also Drive My Car is also high up on my list.
What is it? Drive My Car.
Yeah, it's What's also that? Nominated for an Academy Award.
Drive My Car. I've seen the title around, but I don't really know what it's about. What is it?
Have you seen Licorice Pizza?
I haven't seen that either. That's another one I got to see.
It's okay. Yeah. You might dig it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I kind of like stuff about the 70s and, you know, those types of movies, but. The last few Paul Thomas Anderson movies I haven't been so crazy about. Like, I didn't really love like Phantom Thread, and I wasn't really that into Inherent Vice. I don't know. I just didn't really care for those too much. Did you see those?
Inherent Vice was good, but it was more like a more sophisticated Big Lebowski.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like the big. It's like I have the Big Lebowski, so what do I need to watch another like movie with a stoner goofball detective movie for? I mean, that's like, you know, I don't know. I just didn't do it for me. I just didn't care for that. And I usually like those types of movies. Like, I'm like a big fan of Cheech and Chong and like all those types of movies. But this one just didn't. It just felt kind of like a half-ass. I don't know. I just didn't care for it. But so that's a few of the movies I've seen that I like a lot. And any other important business we have?
I think we can. We've hinted at it a couple times. Where both of us were gearing up for another big one. I think we're gonna eventually do a big episode on Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, Apocalypse Now.
We both want to do it, and
yeah,
maybe we'll do something on Michael Mann at some point.
We have to do a Michael Mann episode with like Heat and Thief or something like, you know, mm-hmm. like a double feature of his movies too. But
yeah,
but yeah, the Apocalypse Now one.
We should probably do one on like Guilty Pleasures.
Yeah, Guilty Pleasures, but I also feel like sometimes like. There's certain movies like where the ones you really want to like talk about a ton, like if I watch like Falling Down or something, like I'll just want to like talk about it with somebody because it's just like one of those movies I love to just like, you know, get people's, you know, thoughts on and stuff, like, you know, like it's just one of those fun like because it was a great like audience movie, like when I went to see it, like when it came out at the theater, it was just one of those films that's just so fun to watch with like a crowd of people, just the
defense
effect of it, you know. Yeah, defense, and you know, like all that stuff. It was just like such a fun movie. So that's the type of movie that would be, and it's not like, you know, it's serious, but it's not like, you know, it's like a genre film. So it's like, it's fun to, you know, it has like a lot of like kind of like dark humor and stuff. So it'd be just be fun to like go through it and like talk about all the stuff that he does and, you know, that type of stuff.
Yeah.
So that would be a fun one to do. Like, so I'm like,
yeah, I need to rewatch it, and then we can do an episode.
You'll watch it, but yeah, this would be a fun one to talk about on a podcast. It's just that has that type of like vibe to it. Yeah, but yeah, To Live and Die in LA was an awesome, you know, just a great. It's you know, it's just a classic of the, you know, the crime genre. We both loved it. So
yeah, so I guess we should do a little shout out for everyone listening. Do follow us on Twitter and Facebook and on YouTube and Anchor and Spotify and wherever you find Furious Cinema, and do leave us your comments and thoughts and whatever, and we'll be back shortly with more Furious Cinema.
All righty. So it was good to talk to you, Seb. We'll catch you next time on the next episode. And
talk to you soon.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and we'll see you next time.
And that's that.